goal for to see if we can manage this is that between today and Sunday, we will be able to chazer most of the whole and stuff. We'll have to move a little bit quickly, but hopefully it should be manageable. So essentially, the parak starts off by telling us about Hasocher es Ha'umnin, a question of what the language of Umnin is meant to convey. The Poel Kavlan distinction is an important one. We know that a Poel is somebody who works by the hour. We hire somebody to work specific hours, that makes him a Poel. And if we give him a job to do, which he does on whatever schedule works for him, so then that makes him a Kavlan. So the language of Umnin, as pointed out by Nostig Stettner and others, seems to be probably inclusive of both. That Umnin suggests a certain kinds of craftsmanship, which means it's probably something closer to a Kavlan, or at least inclusive of a Kavlan, and therefore the term is meant to include both. And we know that right away the Gemara is certainly going to start talking about Poelim. So presumably, the Mishnah as well, so presumably this phrase is meant to include both. So the Gemara talks, the Mishnah first talks about a situation where you have somebody who hires Umnin and he pulls out, or they pull out on him. So the Mishnah says, Ein lahem ze al ze ela tarumis. So this is a very mysterious topic, a very major issue. What does that mean to only have tarumis, or what does it mean to have tarumis in any sense of the word? So first of all, should we perhaps suggest, as the Tiferes Yisrael asserts, that this is simply a way of saying there is no chiyuv mamon in such case. That it's essentially stating a negative. You're not liable, because as Rashi says over here, it was only done bidvarim, we don't have any set commitment, and as we'll see, it seems to be the scenario is that we don't have actual monetary loss, so therefore there isn't any monetary obligation under these circumstances. That's one way to read it, but it's probably not the most compelling way to read it. The idea of tarumis seems to be something affirmative, something that's actually there rather than just the absence of what's there. And it's a phrase that appears in Shas in a lot of different contexts. So we have to answer a couple questions. What does tarumis mean? Now, what's the tarumis for? If the tarumis doesn't represent any monetary loss, so then why do we have the right to this mysterious tarumis? So a lot of the Rishonim adopt the issue as being the tircha. That let's say if we're working under the assumption that people will be able to find substitutes, the workers will find other jobs, and the boss will find other workers. So what right do they have to be upset at all? Their life is perfect, nothing got messed up. So perhaps the issue is simply the tircha. They're going to have to go now and spend time finding a new employer, so that's a schlep. That's not something they had accounted for. So maybe they have the right to have tarumis for that reason, or because maybe they're going to have to do work that's harder for the same money. Maybe it's going to come out to no financial loss, but still, nonetheless, a reason for grousing. The Ritva and a few other Rishonim threw on some other ideas that are not as prominently represented in the later Sifrei Halacha. For example, the idea of Lazus Vasayim, that maybe somebody is going to start spreading rumors, or why did the boss all of a sudden pull out from these guys? Maybe these guys aren't good workers. That could be a reason for them to be upset. And you also find Rishonim evoking, an expression appears in the Gemara later, about Shinoi Das. What does Shinoi Das mean? Does it mean that their plans are somehow thwarted? Or does it mean that they have to deal with different people than they were planning on it? They were planning on working for a certain boss, and now they have to get used to a different boss. And if that's the case, as some of the Sfarim point out, then maybe if this happens before they even start working, they haven't had a chance to develop a relationship with any boss yet, so then maybe it wouldn't apply. So there are a number of theories as to what the cause, what the basis for the tarumis is, but it does seem to focus strongly on the tircha component, on the idea that it's just simply a bother for them to find other work, or vice versa, it's a bother for the boss to find other employees, so therefore you have a right to have tarumas for that reason. So then the question is, so what is tarumas? What does that expression mean? What does it mean to have tarumas? So here also you have a couple of theories. It's really not clear. There's a lot of literature about what it might mean. So one possibility is it could mean you have a right to be angry at the guy. You have the right, essentially, to bear a grudge. So if that's the case, so then you have to, and that's a lot of Achronim have like that, Rabbi Shlomo Salanter has something along those lines, the Chaz Mechezkel, the Chassam Sofer, a lot of Achronim asserted something along these lines. So then you have a number of questions you have to answer. First of all, so what's the Chiddush? Second of all, why should it be permissible if it's a Chiddush? And third of all, what does it accomplish? So the Chiddush is that we know there are Yisurim in the Torah of Lo Sitor, one's not allowed to bear a grudge. That's an Yisur in the Torah in Parshas Kedoshim. And we also have an Yisur over there as well of Lo Yisifna Sachicha Bilvavecha. Now it's harder to believe that we can actually suspend the Yisur of Lo Sisna. That's a little bit of a harder to swallow. So even though some Achronim have that as part of the discussion, it's more difficult to explain why that should be something we should allow. We should be allowed to hate people because of the reversal of the job offer. It's a little bit hard to swallow. But what about the Yisur Netira? So if we say that there is an Yisur Netira, which normally means to bear a grudge, so now that Yisur is suspended. I'm allowed to bear a grudge. So then we have to answer the other two questions. Right? First of all, why should it be allowed if it's normally Asur? Just on a technical basis. And even if we can explain it, what does it accomplish? What's the Mishnah trying to tell us by almost advocating Tarumas in this case? So it could be explained based on the sugi itself of Nekima and Atira. And that's how some do, and we mentioned afterwards that there was a lengthy article towards this end in the journal Torah Sa'adam La'adam, that the Gemara in Maseches Yuma, which talks about the prohibition of Nekima and Atira, has a very mundane context. So let's say I ask David, I want to borrow your snowblower. And David says, I'm not interested in lending my snowblower to the likes of you. So then the next day, David comes to me, and he wants to borrow my desk chair. So I say, I don't think so. You didn't lend me a snowblower yesterday. There's no way I'm giving you a desk chair today. Says the Gemara, that's revenge. It's not exactly what you picture if we talk about vengeance. Not exactly the kind of dramatic image that you conjure up. That's the whole story. That's revenge. So how would it become Netira? Let's pretend the same scenario, but David asks me for a desk chair, and I say, oh yeah, sure, I'll lend that. Because I'm not a jerk, I lend property. So that's called Netira. It's a machlokis in the Rishonim, whether it's just because he said it out loud, if he just thought it maybe it wouldn't be Netira, or maybe that's just the expression of the Netira, but the Netira is, like the word itself suggests, you protect it, you're noter, you hold on to the thought, and therefore that's already an Yisur. It's just expressed through the fact that you're saying something. So then you could say that what we're talking about here is that normally there's an Yisur to bear a grudge, even if you don't take any action, you don't actually do anything that could count as revenge, but you're holding on to the issue, that's already a prohibition. So then why should it be mutter here? So you could say it's mutter based on the simple mechanics of the Yisur, because the Gemara goes on to say that this prohibition of the Kima and the Tira applies when it's an issue of mamonos. Like we just described, essentially this scenario where it's property, and by mamonos we really mean that it's a positive providing of mamon to others. So in any event, so the Gemara makes this distinction that if it's a property issue, like the example given, so then you have these prohibitions of the Nekima Netira. What if it's Saira de Gufa, some type of personal anguish that's being inflicted, so then there is no such prohibition.
So maybe that's what's going on. You could say that that's why this is permitted. It's permitted because this is considered to be a case of tzaira d'gufa. That all the cases where it comes up in the Gemara, there's some type of loss, some type of significant irritation that happens to the person. So it's in this category of tzaira d'gufa, and therefore you can take revenge for that reason. So there are a couple of problems if you follow that approach.
One problem, maybe it's not a problem, maybe it's an elchanami, is that
we should note that wouldn't permit then just the tira, it would permit nekima as well. The Gemara seems to apply that exclusion to both. But also, it's not so clear that this tzaira d'gufa heter exists, or that it's really a good idea.
That the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch both
do not bring such a distinction. And that's a topic of discussion why that is. So there are reasons based on Tamei HaMitzvos you could give to explain why the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch don't make any such distinction. For example, the Rambam, when he talks about the Issur Nekima Netira, he says the reason we have a prohibition is there are two prohibitions is because we're afraid of the Hatfields and the McCoys. That if everybody's going to bear a grudge over every little thing, then they're going to come to take revenge over every little thing. If everyone's going to take revenge over every little thing, then the other side is going to take revenge also. And life is going to fall apart. The world's going to collapse. For the Hatfields and the McCoys, it's not going to be a workable society. So based on that reasoning, you could see why he's not going to distinguish between Tzaira d'gufa and Mamona issues. Or alternatively, the Sefer Achinuch writes that the reason there is such a prohibition is because we have to understand that whatever happens to us in this world, whatever bad things come our way, Chalila, happen because it's God's plan. We don't really understand why, but it's our job to try to deal with it on that level. And if we're going to obsess over the fact that, oh, it happened to me because of him, because of that guy, through the human shliach, so then you're going to lose whatever message it is that God is trying to send you, or for whatever reason it is that he's putting this in your path. So if that's the case, so then we have to wonder. So that would also tell us not to really distinguish between Tzaira d'gufa and Mamona. So from a Tamei HaMitzvos perspective, it's understandable the Rambam and the Chinuch don't record the Gemara's distinction. It's a question, though, what right do they have to ignore the Gemara? So there are a couple of theories within the Rambam. Some point out that there is a Sifrei that says differently, that doesn't have this distinction. Maybe this distinction made rather between Mila d'Alma and Mila d'Shmaya, that you don't take revenge on matters of this world, but if it's a offense against Kavodat Torah, then you're going to have to do something. And it's also possible that different gersos, if you look in the Ritva and Yuma, there may be different gersos in this Gemara. So there might be textual support to not pass them like this distinction. So this whole idea that there is a some kind of exclusion for Tzaira d'gufa, it's not really clear that that's true. The Chafetz Chaim writes in the Sefer Chafetz Chaim that it's essentially a Safek Daraisa, because Machlokas are shown in whether or not to have this exclusion. So since it didn't Daraisa, you have to go L'Hachmer. And Rav Kook wrote in his Haris of Chafetz Chaim that maybe it's strictly speaking Mutter, but it's clearly bad for society, so the Rambam didn't feel a need to record it, to recommend it. So in any event, it's not so clear that there is this exception of Tzaira d'gufa. But let's say for a second there is, and this falls into that category. So still, part of a little bit of a difficulty in this sugya is, so what do you accomplish then? But why would we recommend for somebody to have this tarumas just so he has justifiable upsetness, but it doesn't accomplish anything? So it's a little bit harder to understand what's accomplished. Others suggest that it's not about bearing a grudge or hating the guy, which is, again, harder to justify, but it's about being able to yell at him. You have the right to express your issue with him, to be aggrieved. And there's a third view, which is based on a Rashi earlier, that the idea is that it represents
the ability to speak about the guy, to tell people what happened. So if that's the case, it's some type of an exclusion to the halachas of Lashon Hara, Dayan Silman, the Dayan in Bnei Brak, and the Sefer Darchei Choshen has this approach. A few others have this approach as well. So it seems to be that it's some type of a toelas kind of idea then. That, and it's a chiddush to tell us that it's the toelas. We wouldn't necessarily have recognized that this is within the threshold to be considered toelas, but maybe that's the point, that it is considered to reach that level, and therefore you're allowed to talk about it. Again, the poskim still point out, you don't talk about it to the whole world, but you have the right to talk about it within reason. So what are you trying to accomplish? What's the toelas? That's also an interesting question. You could ask if the toelas is that it's basically considered to be a toelas for others, that if people have these kind of business practices, so it's fair and just that others should be aware of it. And it's in the spirit then of the business websites that have comments and user reviews and the like on Amazon or whatever, so people should be able to comment what you're in for if you engage the service, if you buy this product. Or maybe it's about for yourself, that if a person knows that you're going to be able to complain to others and he can't tell you you're speaking Lashon Hara, so then he's going to have a greater hesitancy to treat you in a bad way. That we know that the ability to have a good reputation is required as a function of successful business, so people are going to be careful if they know there's a hetter that people can talk about their tendency to pull out and the like. So that's another possibility as to what Tarumas represents. And it's also pointed out that Rav Nasan Gishtetn and Rav Nasan Pirio over here has a whole discussion that he thinks the idea of Tarumas is to signify the fact that the person who pulled out did something wrong, that they violated the Hain Tzedek, Lav Tzedek, that they violated the idea of being Omed B'Dibura, and that's a problem, that's wrong. That may not be legal recourse, but it's still wrong of the other person to do, and that's what justifies the Tarumas on the other part. So there are those who understand that the whole purpose of this Tarumas is to get some type of a redress. The Prisha writes that the person has the right to expect some type of satisfaction, some type of request for forgiveness, and some type of appeasement. That's discussed also in that article, Taras Adam La'adam, where he notes that it can't mean that you can force a monetary payment because that becomes the same thing as being chayiv, but you can require that the other guy appease you somehow, and that's apparently his responsibility. It opens up the whole question of whether this is the same thing as what the Gemara calls in the fourth part, Mechusar Amana, and subject to a Misha Para. This overlaps with what we saw in the fourth part, in our Shirim there, talking about the idea of if somebody pulls out of a sale agreement. So the Gemara says he's subject to this idea of Misha Para, that whoever has extracted payment from Anshei Dor HaMabul and Anshei Dor HaMidbar, who asu lipara v'misha eina omed b'divuro, that whoever has made the generations of the flood in the desert pay for their averos is also going to make somebody pay if he doesn't stand by his word. And the Gemara over there has a machlokas, what that means. Is that just some type of a announcement, or is that an actual klala? And if it's a klala, how do you justify a klala based on the prohibition of the Torah to curse people? So the Gemara says the person is not osamai samcha, he's not upholding the national standard, so therefore he's not subject to the protection of this Isser Klala. Rav Sternbach writes in his Chuvas that this again is only there in order to help you get back your loss, in order to have the person rectify the issue with you. It's not stam to be able to push somebody for out of toelis, and he has to therefore be warned. There has to be some type of process where he knows this is coming. And in general, this is a discussion that the Nosa Kedem of the Shulchan Aruch over there in the Shulchan Beis and Shulchan Gimel have, that this idea that there's some tarumas if you pull out, so does that mean that it's mutter to pull out, just the other person has some type of remedy? Or is it a way of saying that it's essentially also to pull out, but it's not really subject to any kind of reparation? Everyone following so far? Everybody doing okay? So there's also a discussion then, what happens if the facts change? If things change on the ground, so you no longer have the same reason to hire somebody. It's not simply capricious or arbitrary, you decide you're going to pull out, but there is some significant basis. So that, many assume, depends on two dais in the Ramah, because the Ramah talks about what happens if there are two sharim, if there are two rates. So the reason you pull out is because you have a very different rate available to you. So is that something that's subject to mechusar emuna? So that was two days in the Ramah, and the Ramah tended towards Chumrah on this question, but many of those came afterwards tended towards Kula, that if there was a significant difference, some kind of an issue that makes things different for the party that wants to pull out, so then they have the right to pull out without Tarumas. And the later posts can write that even within the Ramah, they think that if it's a very big difference, if there's really a whole new landscape, a very big difference in the situation, so then it's justifiable to pull out without even Tarumas. So that essentially got us up to the big sugya that we spent the most of the time on. So we'll try to start it now, and we'll see how much we get done now, and we'll finish the rest on Sunday after a break for Chumash tomorrow. But essentially the question was as follows. That if we look at Tosfos, it's kedai to look at Tosfos together for a second. Tosfos and I involve in the base. So Tosfos is representative of a lot of Rishonim, and it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch in the other way. That the Mishnah that just told us that Eimahem Zel Zel Tarumas, that din that we just heard about, that there's only Tarumas, there is no financial obligation. So says Tosfos, Kashalari, the Hakaimalan Kirib Meir, the Doin Dina de Garmi. What does that mean? It means Tosfos is saying, why are you telling me there is no financial debt? There should be a financial debt. There should be liability. There's a lot contained in that question of Tosfos. You have to know about three or four steps of the conversation that's assumed. You have to kind of work backwards to see what Tosfos is saying. Tosfos is assuming that in the case, this is all before you get to the first word of Tosfos, this is what's the background. Tosfos is assuming that in the case of the Mishnah, there was monetary loss to the party that got pulled out on. And therefore, the question is, since there was a monetary loss, why should we not be able to recover that loss? Why shouldn't we say there is a monetary obligation? So you'll tell me, I can tell you why you can't, because the monetary loss was causational. That's called a grama. And a grama is not something that you're chayiv for. So Tosfos addresses that already again before the first line and says, no, grama you're pater for. But there is a higher level of liability called garmi. And it's a machlokis in the Gemara. Maybe garmi is something that we do collect for. And that's the view of Rebbeir that doyin dina de garmi by gozel kamu kamu daf kuf mar alav. So therefore, Tosfos comes in with the assumption that there is a loss here. The loss is not completely indirect. It's a little bit more direct in the garmi category. And therefore, we should indeed charge the party that pulls out to pay for that loss. So im kein amaylo yitim hem kapol batel. So you should pay the workers like a worker who's not actually working. It's a lower rate. We'll talk about what that means. But he should pay them at some rate. Keva and shayado nisbalu oso hayom. Because since that day, they lost out because of him. So says Tosfos, Yesh lomar demayrik shekeshechoyzer bo o yimtzu lishtaker. That it's still possible for them to get other work that they can get paid for. And to become welcome, Yeshalov Tarumis. But still, even though they can still get a job, they have Tarumis. Sha'ata lo yimtzu el al yidei tarech. So, this job that they're going to get, they can only get through a great effort, so that's why they have Tarumis. It's really amazing if you just dissect this Tosfos. There's so much that's contained within this Tosfos, and we just stopped halfway through. The second half of Tosfos is a sugya that we haven't even addressed yet. And the whole introduction of the concept of halacha, we could just make this Tosfos a mar makom for five shirim. This Tosfos by itself deals with a lot. So first, Tosfos just addressed the question of why there is tarumis. That was the topic we just talked about a minute ago, by explaining that there is torech. And then tells you that it's only Torech, because if there was more than Torech, there would actually be monetary recovery, and that's because of the function of Dina Degarmi. So that is one of the views in Rishonim that you find to explain what's recorded in Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch in Shin Lamed Yemel Beis, the Shulchan Aruch says that this whole idea that there's only Tairumis, that you don't have to pay anything, that's assuming that the workers can get a job somewhere else. But if they can't get a job somewhere else because they committed to you, and now they lost that, so then the employer has to pay them kipol bata. He has to pay them like an employee who's not working. Now, what's the rate of a pol bata? So the Taz mentions that the prevalent attitude is to say it's a half percent, it's a half rate, the 50% rate. And that could be, it really depends on the circumstance. Essentially, it's calculated by asking the guy, if you could take the day off, so if you could sit at home and twiddle your thumbs and not have to work, so how much would that be worth it to you? You don't want to lose your whole salary, but you lose some because you don't have to actually physically exert yourself. So how much would you take for that? What would you take for your job if you didn't have to actually go to work? What rate would you accept? So that's essentially the pol batel rate, which the Taz tells us in most cases comes to about 50% of the normal rate. And as the later post can point out, it also depends. You know, people wouldn't even be willing to talk about it if it was a long term. If you said, what would you pay to, you could be on unemployment the entire year, we'll pay you a check and you don't have to go to work for the entire year, so then you wouldn't be so ready to do that, because you'll say, listen, I'm happy to not have to exert myself, but I need to support my family. I need a salary for a year. Maybe for a day, okay, I could do it. It's worth it to me for a day to be able to stay at home and not come into the office. And for that day, I'll take a lower rate. So then we have to figure out what that would be. So that's the rate of a pol batel. So why should we have to pay this? Why should we have to pay any such thing? So you could take the attitude that there isn't really any actual hezek here. That what the boss did, if the boss cost this guy a day's work, so isn't that what we call menias harevach? Or mevatel kiso shel chaveru, we're holding back profit. We are, so to speak, negating the purse, negating the wallet, which means you're stopping him from making money. And the Yerushalmi says, if you lock the door of somebody's store so he can't profit, so that's a terrible thing to do, but he can't collect from you, because that's not called direct hezek. That's called menias hareva. So how do we say that there is any chiyuv here? So that's the question that everybody talks about. How did it happen? And we spent a lot of time trying to figure out, how did it happen that there should be any chiyuv? That's what the Shulchan Aruch rules. Where does he get it from? So the first way to answer a question like that is to say, Taka is wrong. The premise is not correct. So the Ksos quotes from Rami Rutenberg like that, that indeed this is pure Brahma, amavatel kiso shel chavero, and there shouldn't be any chiyuv, you shouldn't be able to recover any damage in this circumstance. So, and the Ksos himself is somewhat sympathetic to this view, especially because it involves being motzim and amuchsa. Now, does this mean, okay, so we could stop the conversation right here, we could say that the boss is not chayiv, because he can say, I follow the view of the Marami Rutenberg. So Kimli, and the Motsim Echaver Al-Haraya, I follow this view that I don't have to pay. So you need to extract money from me, the burden's on you, too bad. So pretty much all the later posts can agree that that's not an option. That this view of the Marami Rutenberg is first of all not brought in Shulchan Aruch, nor is it brought in the Sma or the Shach or the major authoritative codes that enhance the Shulchan Aruch. And as others point out also, there are conflicting attitudes within the writings of the Maharami Rutenberg himself. So there is this general consensus that the Maharami Rutenberg's position here does not rise to the threshold of being a minority view that you have the right to claim to get you out of the payment team. Okay, so we don't accept that. So what is the basis for the chiyuv? So one way to say is what Tosfos already addressed. Tosfos took it for granted, said it as part of its own question, not as part of the answer to a question. But what was Tosfos' premise here? Dina Degarmi. Right? That, yes, it's causational, but Grama is one thing and Garmi is another. So, Yichai, Dina Degarmi, and that's why there is a Chiyuv here. So, why is that? You have to figure out what's the difference in general. Gemara and Baba Kama, when it talks about Garmi and Grama, what's the difference? So how do we decide? We know roughly what it means, that Grama is purely causational and Garmi is a little bit more your fault. But how do we decide what enters into one category, what enters into another category? So two of the criteria that appear in the Baba Kama discussion, you can apply over here as some of the Achronim do. For example, some say, what does Grama mean? Right, this is a question that comes up in Halacha Shabbos as well. Because the Gemara says in Shabbos and Daf Kuf Chaf that Grama on Shabbos is Pater. So what does that mean? It means if you cause something to happen, you're Pater. But we know that that's not totally true in Halacha Shabbos. We have a concept called Davar Sheino Miskaven and Psik Reisha. So if you cause something to happen while you're doing a different thing, that's not Pater on Shabbos. So Grama must mean something else. So what does Grama mean? So some explain that it means that there's a time delay, that it doesn't happen right away, and your action is now, and the impact comes later. And others build on that and say, yeah, that's called Grama, because once you have a time delay, who knows what could happen in between. So in other words, what makes Grama, Grama? Its lack of definite consequence, the lack of the fact that it will absolutely bring about this result. So to apply that to our situation, there are some who say that, yeah, normally if I lock up your store, so then that's just a grama, because who knows who would have come to your store that day. And maybe you'd have no customers, and even if you have customers, who knows what they'd buy, if they'd buy anything, how much they'd buy, so we can't really treat that as an actual hezek, as an actual monetary issue. But when it comes to the workers, so then you can make a case that they could argue that had you not come and scooped them up yesterday, they definitely would have found work with someone else. That was the environment, that was the market, that there were always people hiring, and you just stopped them from being able to hire themselves out. So that's not simply a grama, that is a bari hezeka, that situation where the damage is clear and foreseeable and demonstrable, and therefore we do collect based on that. That's one way to look at it. Another svar that you see in the grama-garmi distinction is that some say that if you have a whole disconnected type of process where A leads to B and B leads to C and C leads to D, and you end up damaging something along the way, so then that's grama. But if you actually act upon the object itself, the object that's broken, you acted directly on that object, just indirectly damaged it, so then that's called garmi. So there are those who put that into this context as well. And they say that if I lock up someone's door, or even if I break someone's car, or I break their laptop, or whatever it is, I stop them from accessing the resources that they would have to make money. All right, that's one thing. That's kind of indirect. But what if I would lock the person himself up into a closet and not let him go to work? So perhaps that's much more direct. That's really dealing with the person himself in the fundamental sense, his ability to use his own functioning to make a living. Maybe that's much more direct than any other type of prevention of profit. And we find in general, as others point out, that when it comes to Poland, we have all these halachas of extra sensitivity, alav hunosi es nafsho, we have this, we have a din of yomo titen scharo, he has to get paid on time. Because you paid on the day. All of these ideas represent perhaps the fact that Poel, his ability to work with his own hands, to perform his own labor, is something much more direct than simply depriving him of resources that he could otherwise use to make a living.
So there are those who essentially understand that this is not a grama, this is a garmi, and that's really the operative principle. That's one approach. A couple of sub approaches. Another approach that you find, and there are other Rishonim, is that this is the idea of Davar HaAvad, which is based on the Mishnah. The Mishnah tells us about it in the other context. The Mishnah says that, yes, the workers can pull out, but what if you have a situation where the resources of the employer are now exposed, and because there's no worker to take care of it, the workers have pulled out, so if the job goes undone, the item is going to be destroyed. The worker is going to suffer a loss. He opened up his project and now there's going to be a snowstorm today, and if the workers won't close it up, if he ever opened it up in the first place, okay, it wouldn't have been exposed to the snow, but now it's opened up and now we need the workers to finish the job and close it up today before 1 o'clock or 3 o'clock or whatever time the snow is being pushed off to. So now he's got a Davar HaAvad situation. He needs the workers to operate right now. So the Mishnah says he has a remedy. What can he do? Socher aleihem u'matar, either he can hire other workers, cutting it out of their wages, cutting it out of their backs, or he can tell the existing workers, go back to work and I'll pay you more. But then, in the end, actually not pay them more, pay them the original rate, because that was what they agreed to do, and they didn't have the right to back out. So that remedy exists for the Balabas in this category of Davar HaAvad, of something that is going to be going to waste because it's not being addressed right now. So if that's the case, so maybe we should say that the workers have the same type of right, that if they're going to lose money because they can't get a job with someone else now, so they can make the boss pay them for that loss. So that's an approach you find in some of the Rishonim. The quotes, the Ksos quotes the Maharam Shif, who raises the question that it's not really parallel. Here you're telling the Balabas that he has to pay money to these guys, but they don't have an obligation to ever pay money to him. Because all we're told is that if they pull out, so the boss can hire other people on their account, or he can push them to go back to work. But it doesn't mean that they have to pay him cash. So let's say, for example, he decides not to take any of these remedies, and his item really becomes destroyed, his resources really get snowed on or whatever. So then he can't make these workers pay for it. He's not allowed to extract actual money based on this. So how do we know that therefore he should have to pay them money based on the same idea? Doesn't seem to really be parallel. So Ksos explains that it is parallel in a different way. That essentially what this Davar HaAvad means is that each party has to follow through with their original commitment if it's a Davar HaAvad. So the workers had said they were going to go to work, so they're going to have to go through with that, or at least have somebody else work on their cheshbon. And the boss had said he's going to pay them, so therefore he does have to. Parenthetically, you should mention that there is one of you in the Rishonim who disagrees with this assumption that the workers would have to pay out of pocket, and that is the Hagalos Ashri. Hagalos Ashri in 7 days. And this parak writes that the workers would have to pay out of their pocket, and he tries to figure out why our Gemara doesn't talk about that, and he suggests that the reason is that there was no actual loss in that case. So the other Rishonim would disagree with him on two levels. They would disagree that they ever have to pay out of their pocket, and they would say if the other case is no actual loss, that's not even called a davar HaAvad to begin with. So this is a Das Yachid, this view of the Hagalos Ashri. But this Davar HaAvad is another approach,
which, as we'll discuss a little bit later, Akiva Eger points out, it's not the same as Dina Degarmi. This is a whole different mahal. A third approach, a fourth approach, I guess, depending on how you put it, a fourth approach is that of the Ritva. The Ritva and the Shita Mekubeses and the Ritva Hadash Shemir says that if you make a decision because I promise you something, and you end up losing money because of my promise, you rely on me to do something, so therefore I am obligated to pay for your loss. The Gemara gives a case, is what the Ritva is explaining. The Gemara has a case where somebody wants to buy wine at a lower rate, and he sends his shliach, he sends an emissary to go buy him the wine from this place where they have it for less. And he fails to do so, and the guy loses his chance. So the worker has to pay the difference between the cheaper wine and the more expensive wine. So why is that? So the Ritva explains, because the person himself could have gone to get the cheaper wine. Why did he not do it? He didn't do it because this guy promised he would do it. So because he relied on this guy's promise, now things cost him more. Now he only has access to more expensive wine. So he has the right to collect payment for that. This Ritva basically is working off the principle of Arev. That an Arev is essentially a cosigner. So for example, let's say I want to borrow money from Aaron, and Aaron doesn't want to lend me the money. So Adam says, oh, Aaron, trust me, you can lend him. It's fine. He's good for it. No problem. So Aaron lends me the money, and I default. I don't pay. So Aaron has the right, especially after he goes to me, to then go to Adam and ask him to pay, because Adam is the cosigner. He's the artist. So that's the Gemara in the end of Masechet Bava Basra. Comes up in the first parak of Kedushin as well. And the Rishonim all try to figure out what's the nature of that obligation. If Adam didn't borrow any money himself, how could Adam become liable to pay back a debt that he didn't enjoy personally at all? So there are a couple of explanations, but the Ritva, if I remember correctly, the Ritva over there says that essentially Aaron trusted Adam to lend money to me, and because he trusted Adam, so he lost out on whatever money he lent to me. So therefore, Adam has to make good for the loss that comes from somebody relying on his promise, and therefore he has to pay what amounts to the sum of the loan. Okay, so far so good? So this is an important principle, this Ritva. And it's interesting, it's an important question that we actually follow like this lahalacha. So the Chassam Sofer has a tshuva where he says that he thinks that the Ritva is really quite correct, logically speaking. That it really makes a lot of sense. And if it was a situation of a Bari Hazeka, if he knew that it was definitely going to cause such a problem, he would think that you could definitely rely on the Ritva to obligate the problem causer to pay. But if it wasn't a Bari Hazeka, if it wasn't so clear that was the situation, he wouldn't be so quick. And then he adds on, at the end, says he's not 100% sure if this really is agreed upon enough, and if the situation came to him, he would probably try to settle it, probably try to make up shari. But others do agree with the Ritva, the Sivis seems to agree with the Ritva, and Rabbi Akiva Eger says this in his own words. So there is a lot of support for the Ritva's position. But, as the latest Svarim point out, there also are a lot of Svarim that don't agree with it. So it would be very hard to really extract money because of Motsa Mechaver Lovaraya. It would be very hard to really make somebody pay based on this. But there is a lot of support for the Ritva's basic Yesod. The Mordechai that says a little bit differently. The Mordechai says that part of the deal is that if you make a contracted agreement, that if you rely on me and I don't come through, then I will accept your losses. So then that could create a chiyuv, which is taking things a little bit further than the Ritva, and therefore wouldn't necessarily cover all of the Ritva's same cases. There is another element as well that the Ksos emphasizes in his Sefer, that there is a special reason to think that you should be chayav to pay the worker here, because there is a parsha in the Torah of Sheves, right? That if you are chovo v'chavera, if you inflict bodily harm on someone, so then you have to pay five dvarim, you have to pay five different factors, and one of them is Sheves, that the fact that he can't work because he's injured, you have to pay for that. So that could be a model here, that we see that there is a case in the Torah. The Torah tells us such a din, that one is obligated to pay for causing an individual to lose work. However, many question that for a couple reasons. First of all, it's easy to say in both directions that Sheves is when I directly hurt another person directly. But in this case, it's indirect in two ways. The damager is not directly hitting the person who is damaged, and the person who's damaged isn't getting hit by anyone. He's not really hit physically. He's just unable to get employment. It's not so clear it's really a comparable model. Also, as others point out, in the case of Sheves, so you are compensated for the time you can't work because you're injured. But this idea that you should be compensated not only for the time that you're injured, but even after you're no longer injured, but you weren't able to get a job because you were not waiting in line because you were sick, that's already too far removed. So it's not 100% clear that Sheves would apply here. It's also pointed out that it's not clear that we even handle Sheves nowadays. It's not focused on the Chaver and the Ramah. But we know that the general rule is that a contemporary Besdin does not deal with Knossos, doesn't deal with Kefel and things like that, only deals with Mammon. The difference between Mammon and Knoss is essentially that Mammon refers to a actual debt that corresponds to something. So if I bought something for you and I didn't pay for it, I owe you Mammon. If I damaged your property, if I borrowed money from you and didn't give it back, all of those are straight Mammon cases. But if it's a knas, if it's a penalty, so then a contemporary Bezdin that doesn't have smicha, doesn't have a tradition for Moshe Rabbeinu, is not going to impose that kind of a penalty. So therefore, the question could be asked, the five dvarim that a person gets for being injured by somebody else, so how many of those five are mammon, or straight monetary restitution, and how many are knas, or somewhat punitive? So that's the machlokas in Poskim. And there are those who maintain that Sheves is not applied today. So then if Sheves doesn't apply, to say this whole din is not going to apply because it's dependent on Sheves, that probably sounds like a little bit too much to say. So that's itself one of the discussions around this position. And then you have the Nesivis. The Nesivis says here that essentially this is all at Takanas Chachamim. That the whole, he says that about the whole Davar HaAvar idea, that in order to protect the market in both directions, Chazal made a Takana, that we're going to have to take care of each other's losses in this way. So those are some of the answers to that question. If you remember a practical application I sent you guys out from Beis Avad, I believe it was, the scenario where somebody hires a driver to take him to the airport, and after he does that, so his friend calls him up and says, I'll drive you for free. So he wants to pull out of his original deal. So it seems like this is part of the example of the Ramah's case of two sha'arim, that the rates changed significantly, so it should be a tarumas issue. But what if the guy can't get another job anymore? So should you be obligated to pay for that, or to continue to employ him? So that's the assumption they work off of there, that you are obligated based on this, and that could be true. All of these reasons may indeed explain that. But we have to still follow up with some of the ramifications of these reasons and some of the nuances, and also the question of how do we understand the inverse, the whole idea that the employer can collect something from the employee if the employee pulls out, how exactly does that parallel what we've spoken about? So we'll have to pick up on that next time. So just again, so we'll continue with this on Sunday. Tomorrow is got a couple of parshas to talk about. Did everyone understand everything we did today? We went kind of quickly through some pretty involved stuff. So if anybody wants me to repeat anything that wasn't 100% clear, everybody's good? Okay, so then we'll stop here, and God willing, we'll continue in the next time. Shkayach. Who's davening for us? Anyone down for us? Okay. I'm sorry.